Welcome back to The Behavioral Profit, the podcast where we decode the human side of business growth. I'm your host, Debbie Longo, Executive Behavioral Coach. And each week we dive into the mindset shifts, leadership strategies, and cultural behaviors that drive higher performance and greater profits. Whether you're leading a team or building a business, this is your space to learn how human behavior fuels business success. Today, I'm joined by Eric Staples, Director of Growth Strategy and Blue Dog, and the architect behind StoryCraft, an audience impact and influence training that turns complex human insights into on-the-ground momentum-driving habits. For about two decades, Eric has shown organizations how to supplement belief-driven slogans with behavior-driven systems that really stick and help their teams and brands get unstuck. In this episode, he'll unpack why storytelling is often the wrong lens for thinking about presentations and pitches, and there are really only three kinds of people in the world, and how just a little bit of insight can unlock a whole lot of impact. Good afternoon, Eric. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Debbie. Good to be here.
Thanks. Is there anything that you would like to add to that intro?
No, I think you nailed it. I think in particular, the notion of behavior-driven systems is key, which I know is a huge part of your focus on this podcast.
Yes, that was very good. Thank you very much. So there's three topics and some discussion after that.
Cool.
So the first topic is the exchange mindset, transforming every interaction into mutual value.
Yeah, that one is really key. And it's the grounding of, for Blue Dog, all the things that we do, and particularly the organizational upskilling that I lead across a number of different trainings. You mentioned StoryCraft, and that's kind of the cornerstone training. And in particular, that one, although it is StoryCraft, that's what it's named, it's a bit of a almost a bait and switch, because it's less about sort of classical storytelling tips and tropes, the kind of things you would expect to find if you Googled storytelling training or storytelling, how to be a great storyteller. And it has more in common with the fundamentals of negotiation. If you were to take like a 301 negotiation course, you'd see some similar principles applied a bit differently, but like-minded. And that's because at Blue Dog, anyway, we believe that everything is an exchange. Every professional interpersonal interaction, whether it's a presentation, a pitch, a workshop, or even just a quick, like, incidental one-on-one hallway conversation, it's an exchange. You're seeking something from the person or people you're talking to, which means they need something from you in order to give you that. And what I've found is that moving from a mindset of, I've got a story to tell, I've got a message to give, I've got an outcome to ensure, which are not wrong ideas, but they're not the first idea. The first idea is there's an exchange to be made. What is that exchange? How is that exchange made? That's the most effective starting point.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Just to comment on one thing that you said, what I do is one of the reasons why I do this podcast, The Behavioral Profit, is to showcase and present different industries, careers. And when I do that, that allows somebody that is in this type of industry or maybe wanting to get into it, compare and be able to maybe identify or just be curious about how does the behavior relate to this industry. And that's why I ask for the topics and the questions that the guests want, because it's about, well, first of all, it's the show for the guest. It's not the show for me. So even though I'm hosting it, but the point is, the reason why it's the show for the guests is because I'm trying to get more focus on this specific type of industry, which is why I don't only focus on one thing, on one aspect. Yeah. And when I do that, because I'm focusing on the behavior and the personality and what happens in this industry, in this job, in this career, and I'm trying to get as many listeners an overview of all different types of audiences that maybe somebody, something somebody can relate to, and maybe they could identify with that. Or maybe they're just curious, whatever the situation is. It could be a million different situations. So the basically, I'm trying to get a broad range. That's kind of basically the thing. So the other topics that we're talking about here, you know, we're going to get into this. But this exchange model is very interesting because I am maybe exchanging something for something. Am I exchanging one type of mindset for another? Am I exchanging a negative for a positive? So if I go to the store, I want to buy something, I have to pay for it with money. That's an exchange. I'm giving them money and they're giving me something. But there's also an exchange with mindset. I know you talked about a different thing. Well, similar, I'm trying to get, you know, similar to what you're talking about. But when I read this and when I listen to you, this is kind of what I get from it.
And I think to a point that I think you're speaking to, this is the universal truth. There always is an exchange. You're always wanting something. And that means you always need to give something. And I think that is one of the biggest misses in corporate America in particular, the spaces that I work in, is one of two things happens. Either the person just instinctively goes in and says, here's what I'm trying to get out of this, and doesn't think about the other side of that exchange. Or equally unhelpfully, they say, this is what they need to hear from me. And they're not thinking about it as an exchange either. I think even most simply, I was just doing a training for a client an hour ago, right before this, around what we'll talk about soon, this head, heart, gut model. And even there, although I was giving them information, what I wanted from them and needed from them was their attention and their engagement. And so if I walk in there and say, I want their attention and their engagement, what do I need to give them in order to get those things from them? That changes my mindset. And it changes the way I even might measure my success in that situation. If I just walk in and say, I'm the messenger, they need to listen to what I have to say, I'm missing out on the bulk of the actual equation that will drive something meaningful out of that exchange.
Yes, that was good. Thank you. Okay, so let's talk about the head, heart, gut model and an overview of that and what that exactly means.
It's my favorite tool of all tools. And it's something that we at Blue Dog use in essentially every meeting, every conversation. And you already teed this up, Debbie, a moment ago. There are essentially, reductively, but not inaccurately, three kinds of people in the world. That's the assertion. Head, heart, and gut people. This is not new news, necessarily, this notion of head, heart, gut intelligences or the three brains, different kinds of decision-making filters. But what's different about the way that we treat it is most of what you would read if you were to pick up Forbes or HBR or a leadership development book says to be an effective leader or even an effective person, you need to know when to lean into your head, when to lean into your heart, and when to lean into your gut, which is true, but not particularly helpful because none of us have equal propensities or fluidities across those three spaces. And all of us have a set of defaults in one of them. I've been using this tool for 10 years-ish in both the corporate side and growth consulting and as a growth coach for individuals and teams. This is the number one tool behind them. And I've yet to meet anyone across hundreds and hundreds of people that didn't have a default, a way that they prefer to process information, navigate decisions, et cetera. And the thing that I want your audience to hear from that is if you don't know what your defaults are and what your audience's defaults are, then you could be talking right past each other and fundamentally not understanding what each other are needing out of that exchange. And so head, heart, and gut, and there's a whole model behind it, and I'm not going to go into the depths of unpacking it here, but it's essentially a shortcut to emotional intelligence and audience empathy. And you can imagine, the last thing I'll say before I take a little pause and a breather is, you can imagine what those things mean. I mean, heads have a particular tendency towards logic and reason, and hearts have a tendency, they tend to compass or center around belief, conviction, connection. Guts sort of center their decision-making in instinct, progress, movement. Those are different things. Those are different sets of needs and a different set of value, actually, that is really helpful to understand if you're going to be working with people, and certainly really important to understand if you're looking to impact and influence people. Does that check out? I mean, you've talked to a lot of people. Can you see those patterns yourself?
Yes, definitely. And that was very good. But I think maybe, I know you just, it's an overview, so you described it briefly. So I'm sure there's more to it than this. But my emotions and my thinking and my behavior, number one, can be adjusted. Like we just talked about, the exchange, negative, positive, whatever it is. I don't know if this has any, this is about what it, this is, but I don't really want to have one thing control me or overpower another thing. So one part of my personality, right, overpowers another part, or empathy might overpower me being fearful. So I want to try to make it as even as possible, like an even swap kind of thing. And if I could do that, so one would be like doing something to excess. I'm doing too much of one thing, like I'm too empathetic all the time with everything. And then it turns out then, like I find that one thing will wind up controlling another thing. So one part of your behavior will wind up controlling another part. And then there's a lot of issues with that. Not only that, that just that is a problem within itself, but then there's a lot of things that could happen because I might be, because I'm emphasizing one part more, right? Then there are issues around me, the way other people react and stuff. That could be a little bit overbearing. And then one person says, why are you this way? The other day, you were not this way. So that's why it could be a lot of issues with that. So I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but that was what I was thinking when you were talking.
Yeah, and I think that's a great reason to not live within the default limitations and default momentum that these centers do naturally create. What you're speaking to is actually why it's so important to surface these things, but also realize the limitations of our ability to just immediately be the well-rounded people we want to be. The point of head, heart, gut as a model of understanding the decision-making tendencies and momentums of different kinds of people is to help us make those things visible so that we can value the things that are really helpful for me as a head. I have value to add that is different than the value of my coworker, Jake, that is different than the value of our CEO, Shannon, who's a heart and a gut respectively. So I can understand that actually those represent different dimensions of decisional value between these things, reason, logic, thinking, that's the head. Connection, beliefs, conviction, that's the heart. Instinct, value, progress, that's the gut. Which of those could we cross off in an important decision? None. Which of those is most important in an important decision? That actually depends on the decision itself. And so one of the things that I dislike about a lot of typing tools, like, for example, Myers-Briggs, a bit of a love-hate relationship with that, is because it tends to separate. And it says reductively, I'm an introvert, you're an extrovert, and that's why we can't quite ever fully reconcile. This says the opposite. It says, I do have tendencies because of how I'm hardwired. That's good. That's, but I need to know how to use those tendencies well and know what limitations they create. And ultimately, I think, Debbie, to your exact point, over time, become as well-rounded as I can possibly be. My journey was, I started off as a very immature head. And I used to say this, you will either laugh or roll your eyes. I used to say, I don't have opinions. I have data and there are implications. Hard stop. It's a very immature thing to say, a very naive thing to say, but that was my mental map told me that's the way the world looked. None of us see the territory for how it actually is. We all see through the filters of our own mental maps. This notion of head, heart, gut is just the fastest way to get to the basic knowledge of what the other person's mental map looks like, so you can better connect and communicate with them and better know how to pull the right kinds of value from them.
Sounds good. Yeah, that is very good.
One of the most interesting distinctions here, Debbie, that I think when I play this out with audiences, this is where it really raises the eyebrows and, oh, that's interesting, is let's imagine you've got a head, a heart, and a gut. Head, a heart, and a gut walk into a bar. This is not a joke. This is a illustrative scenario. And they're trying to make a business decision or trying to make any kind of major decision that they're all equally invested in. And the head says, well, this is the right answer. And the heart says, no, I think this is the right answer. And the gut says, no, you're both wrong. This is clearly the right answer. The problem isn't just a difference of opinion or a difference of perspective, although those also are at play. The problem could very well be that what a head means when they say right is different than what a head means when they say right, different than a gut. When a head says this is the right answer, they mean it's true, logical, supportable. When a heart says this is the right answer, they mean it's good, it's desirable, it's beneficial, it's helpful. When a gut says this is the right answer, they mean it's valuable, it's useful, it'll move the needle, it'll keep things rolling. Which one of those is all three to some degree? And so understanding how to decode some of the invisible and implicit implications of even the same language that is actually meaning to these people is, I find, immensely, immensely helpful.
Yeah, thank you. Did you ever hear of the second brain?
Mm-mm.
I have a book on it. It's your gut.
Oh, yeah, sure. Oh,
I have a book on it. It's very interesting.
That I think is really interesting. There are actually three brains. So the science behind this, which is exactly what you're speaking to, Debbie, there are neuronal clusters, as you said, in the gut that are activated and involved in instinctual decisions. Likewise, there are the same kinds of neural clusters in the chest cavity area that are activated and involved in emotional decision-making. Now, what I don't want you to hear me saying is reducing these three types of people to stereotypes. I mean, head, heart, gut is reductive enough. I'm not saying that it's the logic ones, the empathy ones, and the instinct ones. It's a little more complex than that. Empathy in particular is something that is a skill, not an innate quality and characteristic that only belongs to certain people. But it is an emotion similar. We're not saying that heads are the non-emotional ones and hearts are the emotional ones. But it is interesting, to your point, Debbie, that like there's actual science, decision-making science, that backs up the fact that we operate differently and even access different parts of our biology when we make different kinds of decisions. And all that we're saying, Blue Dog, as a sort of creators of this model, is that everyone's going to have defaults, and it's helpful to know what those are so you can give people what they need. Let me give you, if I can, one more quick example of how this shows up. I talked about what they mean by right is completely different. We can imagine, too, there's what they're good at is different. Heads are really good at things like process and systems and strategy and methods. Hearts are really good at imagining possibilities and generating enthusiasm and vision, mission, things like that. And guts are really good at getting things done, navigating the system, disrupting the system, maneuvering tactics, et cetera. It's no surprise then that guts tend to over-index in higher levels of leadership. The more you get things done, the more in the ranks you grow. Now, what is most human about this is what each of these head, heart, gut fundamentally need from others is also quite different. A head, at the end of the day, most reductively, needs to feel that their perspective is valid. That's what they're looking for. A heart needs to feel that their person is valued. And a gut needs to feel that their path is supported. Now, you might say, and you rightly say, everyone needs to feel that their person is valued. Yes, but none more than hearts. And frankly, if you're going to give positive feedback to a head and you value their person, they will receive that less eagerly than if you say, that thing you said 2 minutes ago was really super duper smart. That's sort of a love language for the heads. Likewise, I've talked to leaders that were gut leaders that were some of the best people leaders I've ever worked with. Kind, empathetic. But at the end of the day, what they really want from the people around them is get on board with what I'm trying to do, because what I'm trying to do is. And so if we don't know those fundamental needs, and I've got story upon story that I won't bore you with here, but we can talk right past each other and not only not give each other what we're needing, but actually rob each other of what we're needing if we don't know those things.
Very true. All very good stuff. Next topic, behavior systems versus belief systems. What does this look like day to day?
This is an active topic of conversation at Blue Dog amongst the senior leadership. We are sort of leads of different practice areas. And we've been talking quite a bit over the last even few months around chicken or egg. What comes first and what's more influential in actual adoption? And that's kind of what we are talking about here all the time. Behavior and ways of doing and even ways of thinking are not just like concepts that float around and we put them in or we put them on and now they're ours. We adopt things. We integrate things into our day-to-day behavior or we don't. We, as you said, Debbie, we habitualize things or we don't. And chicken or egg, what's more important in habitualization and adoption? Belief systems or behavior systems? And I tend to think that most behavioral science, at least directionally supports or indicates this, that behaviors are more important in creating an adoption than beliefs. And moreover, while beliefs will create behaviors, for sure, something that is overlooked and oftentimes even more formative and powerful is that behaviors will create beliefs. And so don't hear me say you can do without one or the other, but do hear me say most, not just organizations, but most human institutions have sort of a unspoken, unchecked assumption that beliefs create behavior exclusively, that that's the direction of the line. And I want to say, actually, some of the most formative forces in our lives are behaviors that start to create our beliefs, or at least they entrench our beliefs. And you can know that because I'm sure you've talked to many people and you have yourself been a person who said they believe something, but their behavior indicates something very different. I believe I am a confident strategist, but I'm up there shaking during the presentation. That means I really believe something different and my behavior is showing it. And the more you can behave, I mean, that's another way to say fake it till you make it, behave in the direction you want to believe, the more that belief gets actually humanly entrenched in our psyche, which is where it needs to reside for us to truly adopt any new habit.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you wrote verses indicating mm-hmm. that it's the opposite, not similar. Mm-hmm. But you explained how one thing goes into the other and the reason why we have one thing.
Yeah.
But the comment that I want to make is, I feel that sometimes, I guess just for myself, it can work both ways. Because if I behave a certain way, I might or might not believe that.
Yeah.
That is a fact of a belief, which really isn't a fact, but to me it is. But then if I believe something, I might not behave that way. I might right. or might not. So to me, that might depend on not really my personality, but maybe the way that I feel that day, my mood. It might not be something that I permanently believe or don't believe, but maybe there's a lot of things that might change my decision or the way that I think. So to me, it could work both ways. But I always think too of the environment around me, the people around me, and are they going to accept what I'm going to say? Are they going right. to accept what I believe, what my behavior is now or is going to be? Okay. Maybe mm-hmm. a family member, like an immediate family member or a child. So my environment and my community also might mm-hmm. want to accept that or might not. And I might believe something or I'd say that I do just to satisfy my family, let's say, for example. I might not believe it or I might not know if I believe it or not. A behavior is one thing to me because people can affect my behavior, of course. But to me, that's a little bit more deeper into it. But if I believe something, I might not necessarily believe it. But if the people around me believe it, and then I might just say that I believe it for like 100 different reasons.
Well, I think that actually is a good example of exactly the distinction that I'm driving. And to your point a moment ago, the verses is not about opposed ideas. It's about distinct ideas. And my provocation is not at all that it only works one way. It does. These things work together completely. My provocation is actually, especially in the corporate world, there's a whole half of that that is almost entirely missing. The assumption, often unspoken, but the assumption is if you just get everyone to believe the right things and believe in the same ways, then they will do the behavior you're seeking. I'm here to tell you, behavioral science would say something different. Behavioral science would say the belief without the behavior, we can't really know that that's a belief. And a belief with the behavior will actually reinforce the belief. And so I think there's a colloquialism. You want to know what someone actually believes? Look at how they behave. Why that's important, and Debbie, I think this is, you tee this up quite a bit in the things that you do and the way that you talk. Incentivize, organizations need to be incentivizing behaviors as much, if not more, as they are reinforcing beliefs. If the reinforced beliefs, I don't care how many times you say, here are our values and here's our purpose and here's our, all the other belief systems that an organization will have. Doesn't matter how many times you reference those things and reinforce those things, if you're not incentivizing the behaviors that should flow from those things, then you're leaving it at a concept, and concepts don't actually change situations, cultures, et cetera. Concepts don't, behaviors do, quite to your point.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you for that. Lightning round, biggest misconception about decision-making.
I'm actually with a coworker right now finishing a whole training around decision-making, and it's called the 7 ditches of decision-making and how to avoid them. Because I think that's the biggest misconception. People think, or at least they desire, the right way to make a decision or the right ways to make a decision. And sadly, there is no right or best or single way to make a decision, but there are, we think, 7 ways to wreck them. And so if you can avoid the ditches of decision-making, and some of that is emotional intelligence, some of it is default thinking, some of it is, et cetera. So there's 7 of them, of course. Maybe that's for another podcast in the future. If you can avoid the ditches, then oftentimes anywhere in the road, which can be multiple decisions, multiple paths, is probably good enough. And that kind of coincides with this notion that was really transformative to me when I first heard it, satisficing. Are you familiar with that phrase, satisficing? That's great. Most of us are looking at how we measure the success of our decisions in terms of, like, it has to be a perfect outcome. It has to be exactly what I'm looking for. And that is most likely to lead us to being disappointed, even if we made a good decision, because almost nothing will work out exactly perfectly. And so here again, you'll hear me say behavioral scientists a lot because they're kind of my heroes, but behavioral scientists would say satisficing, which is a morpheme between satisfying and sufficing, a satisfaction that is sufficient enough to be a box check. That's what your measure should be. And if you take those two things, that there's no one way to make a decision, but there are some ways to wreck decisions, and whatever you do, don't look for perfection, look for satisficing in your success metrics, you'll find yourself way happier with your decisions and much more confident in your decision-making over time.
Yeah, that was good. Thank you. I definitely agree with that. And to me, that's a solid way, making a decision rather than 100 other ways. Thinking about it and making a quick decision, not thinking it through.
Well, to that point, I know this is a lightning round and I'm slowing down the storm here, but that also is part of our decision-making training is this head, heart, gut model, because those are defaults. And you know what? A gut should know that they're going to feel most comfortable and most satisfied making a gut decision. And they're also going to nudge into the limitations of that and the situations in which that's not the best idea. Meanwhile, a head, that's me again, needs to know that, yes, a long, robustly researched pros and cons list can be helpful. That's the way that I want to make a decision, but we don't always have time for that. And so even that, know where you lean and know what you need to watch out for, and then make the decision as fast as possible, to your point.
Yes, perfect. Thank you. One prime behavior shift leaders can try this week.
Well, Debbie, I'm going to steal from you. You had a sort of opening offer for this that I think is one of the greatest things I've ever heard for a try it for a week exercise. So I'm just going to read the suggestion you had and vehemently agree with it. Experiment for a week even. I think you could see results in a week. Even better if you do it for a month. And maybe the heads out there in the audience would say, let me get some data for a longer trial period, but treat every professional interaction as an exchange. Not as a, I need them to hear this or I need to get this from them, but give and take. What do they need from me? What do I need from them? And ask yourself, and maybe even ask the other person very directly, what they need in this interaction to make this successful. And then do everything you possibly can, as you said, everything feasible to provide that thing to them. And then see the difference in, and I love you said both of these, Debbie, in both outcomes and relationships. I love that. I think that's a wonderful experiment. I guarantee if everyone listening right now did that, everyone would see a significant change in their efficacy and their enjoyment as well. I love that idea.
Yeah. And what about doing something out of the box, doing these things that we're not familiar with and we don't want to do them and we don't know, there's a fear of the unknown. We don't know if it's going to produce results and what the outcome is, and might work out, it might not. I want to do, if I do an experiment, and you said it exactly the way that I wrote it, but I want to do an experiment or try something new, I want to just do it. Because if I think and I overthink it and I'm thinking and thinking, then it just, not only I'll probably talk myself out of it, but I might not get a positive outcome of it because I'm not focusing on what it is and what the goal is and what it really is. I'm just saying, making something up or just saying, I don't know if it's going to work or not. And then I'm turning it into something it's completely not.
Yeah. Well, I mean, interestingly, and this is a total aside for fun, it sounds like, and one can be diagnosed by other people, but it sounds like you might be a gut. That sounded like some gut-ish sort of tendencies, which is interesting. I want to reinforce two things that you just alluded to. The first is, and this goes back to the point of this whole experiment for a week. Look, if you want to get someone on your side, the very best thing you can do is first get on their side. That is, every negotiation professional will tell you that. And so how do you get on someone's side? Asking questions, putting yourself in their shoes. You can almost never get someone on your side without first getting on their side. So that's just an interesting corollary to this. And then the second thing that is within something you just said is there's a myth. It blew my mind when I first heard this. There's a myth that people fear change. People don't fear change. They fear loss. And the problem is times of change represent greater likelihoods of loss. So here again, if you are in a tense situation, that is still going to be an exchange. But you putting yourself in the other person's shoes and you see fear operating, maybe it's because they're self-promoting or self-protecting, and that's what we do when we're afraid. You see fear operating. Don't look at that and say, oh, that person is behaving badly. Say, that person is sending a signal that there's a fear here. What is that fear? How can I help them with that fear? How can I come alongside them and help actually manage that fear? And I'll tell you what, that is a really empowering truth for both you and the other person, because sitting there and saying people fear change, there's nothing you can do about that. Grinning gut through it, but knowing that people actually fear loss, that's something we can do something with, both with and for each other. And I think that's really powerful.
Yeah. So just one closing comment that I want to make. So we talk about the workplace in my podcast, but in a lot of them, I transfer that what you do and how you think and how you act in the workplace can go into your personal life, your home life, into your community, your friends, your neighbors. And I think this was a discussion that we just had that can work both ways. And we just talked about it generally. We didn't necessarily say one time, I think we did during this whole podcast, that it was about the workplace, different things. So if you're a listener, maybe you could relate to this, maybe not, but just think about if you want to continue to listen to it, just think about where that's going to relate to you, whether it's the workplace or your home specific situation you're in, because this, I think, can work with anything. It doesn't matter what it is.
Because all of the things that we're talking about are human constructs and concepts. I couldn't agree more, Debbie. And in fact, like I said, I just had a training on this exact model, this head, heart, gut model this afternoon. And invariably and inevitably, people say, oh, this explains a lot about my marriage or my partnership. We had one person tell a story. She's like, I'm a head, my husband is a gut, and my daughter is a heart. And this actually helps unlock why we are oftentimes in completely different directions. It's not because we can't come together on things, it's because we are actually viewing the world through different maps and different lenses. And that's actually a good thing. That's a good and valuable thing if we harness it correctly. So yeah, couldn't agree more.
Yeah, that was good. Thank you. Is there anything you would like to say in closing?
It was just a real pleasure talking to you. And thanks for giving me a little bit of a space to share some of these things that I really, really love a lot and really passionate about.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for being on the show. How can they get in touch with you?
BlueDogDesign.com is a great way to see kind of the full spectrum of the things we do as an organization. Eric, E-R-I-C at BlueDogDesign.com is my direct email if there's something you're interested in hearing or learning more about. And in fact, Debbie, I'll maybe shoot you a few images, screen grabs from the presentations so that you could post them up for your listeners. And that way, as they're kind of listening, they could have a little bit of visual reference material, which I know always helps in learning.
Perfect. Cool. Thank you for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you.